Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of December 4th, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best-informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. My name is Mayan Kreitzman.
And I'm Neil Janssen. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
On today's show, we have a bunch of on-location recording tidbits from various happenings around campus. We'll also check in with Justin McElroy to talk football and the football team's big win. In the second segment, we'll have an interview with Sauter professor Jennifer Birdall to discuss leadership dynamics, academic freedom, and searching for the next UBC president.
On with the show.
So, Neil, on news today, we went around campus with our handy-dandy recorder and checked out a bunch of little events. The first one was that we stopped by an appropriately ironic protest, which was a little funerary procession for Thunder, a plush doll version of UBC's mascot. So here's some sound from that event.
You're the organizer, right?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to tell us what the purpose of this somber fair is?
Okay, so the purpose of the funeral is because I do kind of believe the spirit of UBC is dying, and it's dying because it's succumbed to this corporate cynicism and greed, where our tuition is being raised for internationals, because I'm international, 46.8%, which is a ridiculous exponential sum. And also just the way the university is botched and poorly handled these cases of sexual assault is embarrassing. After the past 2 years, we've seen like multiple scandals, and the university's only gotten involved when outside news sources have become involved. And it's embarrassing, and I think it's a disservice to the students. It feels more and more like I'm back in America, back in an American institution that only cares about money and ratings.
And do you think the Board of Governors is going to notice tomorrow?
Probably not. I don't know. I don't think so. I'm doing another small protest tomorrow morning. But I still wanted to do something and to try and give a voice.
Yeah, I know, but like,
it's an open casket affair.
It is an open casket affair, yes.
Our second stop of the evening was an open house put on by UBC Campus and Community Planning.
So Neil and I are here in the Alumni Center looking at a whole slew of mock-up posters for
open house for the new Gage South project, which is going to be a brand new bus loop with a whole bunch of student housing on top.
And we're going to try to nab a couple of the folks here to explain the plans to us. So here we are at the Gage South open house, looking at a floor plan poster with Andrew Parr, who's in charge of student housing on campus. So we see some little micro units,
yep.
Some one bedrooms, some studios, and
quite a mix of units. Mm-hmm. This complex has six different types of units. And part of it's strategic in terms of wanting to get a certain type of unit into this complex and into the mix of inventory that we offer.
So is this in the category of university housing, which is sort of market rental, but for people associated with the university, or is this like a classic residence?
This is classic residence. This is in the category of purpose-built student housing.
So there's been a lot of news that you've generated for these micro units, or possibly even nano units, and we're looking here that there is a floor plan for these, finally.
Yep.
It just has a small washroom.
Yep.
One side of it is a closet, a desk, as well as a kind of kitchen area, and with a bed and a chair.
Yes.
So have these been mocked up? Have you tried to spend a night in one or anything?
They will be mocked up. So one of the commitments that I made, that I was really interested in doing this because, but you've summarized it absolutely correctly. All of that you just listed is in 144-ish square feet, so, you know, very small. We are going to mock it up. What we want to do is build a life-size, full-size mock-up. Ideally have it set up in the Student Union building and let students come in and, you know, touch and feel and play with it.
And have you had indications that people are interested in those kinds of micro units?
Yeah. I mean, our, not every student by any stretch. I mean, there's a few students that, and I probably, if I was a student, I'd be in that category. But that's probably not a living environment that I'd want to live in. But there's a lot of students that, for the right price, they could see living in there and having a lifestyle that's conducive with, you know, with the lifestyle that's important to them. We also have one bedrooms here. And this is an interesting one. So the one bedroom is quite large. This is, one bedroom for one student. It's a very large space. And and a student that has the financial wherewithal or desire to live in an environment like that could rent this and rent it for themselves, but we'll also allow them to sub-rent or have a roommate that they could share that rent with. So it could be a partner, or it could be a stranger that they reach out to and get a roommate, and then they could share that space, and that would become quite affordable.
Well, thanks for letting us chat about these floor plans, Andrew.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest.
When we were heading back to the CITR studio, we just happened upon a celebration in the new sub with a bunch of cake and the shiny Vanier Cup, which is returning to UBC after the football team's big win.
Would you mind talking to us?
Sure.
For a few moments? So what is your name and what's your position?
My name's Gord Hopper. I'm Director of Athletics, Performance, and Team Support.
What does that mean?
That means that I'm the administrator that looks after all of the teams, so program director.
Program director for the varsity.
For 25 varsity teams.
So what can you tell us about what we're looking at right now?
We are looking at the Vanier Cup, and it is...
it's a little lopsided. What's going on with that?
By design. It is a sought after trophy, and we're pretty excited to have it here at UBC again.
No, okay. Why is it lopsided then? Why is that part of the design?
I have no idea. It has always been that way.
Always been
the
that
cup
way.
Is tilted
since the beginning, not since that accident that someone had.
Correct.
20 years ago. Okay. And how many times has UBC won this?
This is the fourth.
The fourth time?
Yes, it is.
And first since 1997?
Right? First since 1997, so we're pretty excited to be bringing it back home.
So you've been with athletics for a year. How many championships have been won by the Thunderbirds while you're here?
Well, we've had four this year, and I would need to count how many we won last year.
With more coming, right?
With more coming, yep.
Most students don't care about varsity. Is that going to change?
It absolutely is going to change. I mean, in partnership with the university, we make an investment of raising the profile and making it relevant. Homecoming was the first example. We want this varsity athletics to go well beyond the athletes who are in it. It needs to be an experience for the whole campus to be valued.
We've been talking to Gord Hopper from UBC Athletics. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Joining us over the phone right now is Justin McElroy, who is a former coordinating editor of the UBC, big sports fan, and now works for Global News. Justin, we were just outside the CITR right now, and we saw the Vanier Cup. What can you tell us about UBC's recent victory?
Well, I mean, that's a sight that hasn't been seen on campus since 1997. And, of course, UBC wins a lot of national championships, field hockey, swimming, soccer. It's rare a year goes by where you don't see UBC at least in the finals for one of those. But football, of course, has the highest profile nationally. It occasionally does show up on national TV, and it's the one sport where dependably once or twice a year at least 4,000 or 5,000 fans, many of them students, come out to a game. So for something like this to happen, obviously it's a great thing for the football program and everyone connected to it, but it's certainly the most visible sign for the vast majority of students and the Vancouver community as a whole of UBC's athletic power.
Is it just a fluke that they won this year when there was sort of a push by the AMS and other people to make football a bigger deal?
This was a team that people thought would be all right. They brought in a new coach, Blake Neal, who's very well regarded. New quarterback, Michael O'Connor, certainly has a good pedigree, but people thought they were going to be, you know, just an above average team. But the thing about playoffs, no matter what sport you're in, is you suddenly get on a hot streak and things can happen. And so here we are.
Do you think this success is sustainable? Is UBC going to be a credible threat for the Vanier Cup for the next few years, or is this kind of a one-time Cinderella story that worked out quite well in the end?
Well, I mean, once you get to the playoffs, keep in mind you have to win three single elimination games to get to the Vanier Cup, so you can never say that you're going to be the overwhelming favorites. That being said, UBC's athletic community and a lot of the alumni, led by David Sadu, of course, are putting a lot of money into the program now, well over seven figures. That helps with recruiting, that helps with training and injury rehabilitation, and that's the model in the CIS now, whether it's LaBelle's football program, whether it's Carleton's basketball program. You get alumni to step up, you create a wide support network for all of your players, and you can win. So a program that 2 years ago, as everyone as said, was possibly on the bubble because of UBC's controversial letter for review, is now one that looks to be in very good shape for the foreseeable future.
And we just saw David Sidhu walking up the stairs at this celebration out in the sub. We also glimpsed the actual Vanier Cup, which is a little lopsided. Do you know why?
I don't know why.
It's a sort of funny-looking cup. Anyway, it's no rather idea. Ornate.
I mean, when it gets handled by as many exuberant young people who may be a little bit inebriated as it surely has over the 50 years, it's bound to get a little bit dinged up, right?
Right. Thanks, Justin.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
We also stopped by the Alumni Center on Thursday to get some comments on the board meeting that was happening there. So we just caught Veronica Knott outside of the boardroom as people are going to lunch.
Do you want to talk about tuition?
In what sense?
Well, I guess we're wondering if the directive from the committee meeting to lower the tuition by a few thousand dollars for those big four programs actually happened.
Yes, it did. That was all in Appendix A, which is online, but they met and all of the recommendations were kind of taken into consideration, and Angie presented on that as well.
And were you happy with that?
I think it's great that those conditions were met, and it's also good to see a lot of the programs actually got pulled off and are going to go back for consultations.
Which programs were removed?
The dual degree masters, the Masters of Arts and Economics, and I think there was one other program which I have written down, but I don't have it with me.
And was that enough to purchase your and Julie's votes?
No, we still voted against. We had concerns with some of the diversity stuff, which we explained, and so we still will continue to question and comment on that. So,
okay, thanks, Veronica.
No worries.
The one story we'll talk about in the studio this week is about a new appointment to the Board of Governors. Last week, the BC government named Stuart Belkin to the UBC Board of Governors to replace John Montalbano.
So Neil made a post on the blog, which was swiftly copied by the UBC, which points out that Stuart Belkin is the CEO of his family business, a multi-millionaire who has made upwards of $100,000 in donations over the years to the BC Liberal Party. And so this appointment is typical. My big question is, like, why is sitting on the UBC Board of Governors still considered some sort of, like, plum thing? Is it such a big privilege to volunteer your time to sit on a board of a university? I don't quite get it.
Looking at the various board appointments that are available through the province, it's certainly a lot more prestigious than going to the BC Broiler Egg Hatching Marketing Board. UBC is a huge institution that does a lot of stuff, so even though it's volunteer, I'd imagine that there is some power and prestige that comes with it.
I mean, we've said before on the show that we think that it could be good to have a bigger diversity of people on the UBC Board of Governors, not just people coming from a business background. Any intelligent person could usefully contribute their expertise and knowledge to sitting on the board of, like, a really important public institution.
And the fun thing is that I discovered this week that applications are always open to sit on the UBC's board, and anyone can apply. We'll throw the link up on the show page, and I encourage everyone and anyone to put your name in for that posting.
If anyone wants some inspiration, you can also look on the blog and check out Neil's application letter offering up his candidacy for a position on the Board of Governors himself. It's very funny.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Our guest today is Jennifer Birdall, who is, and this sounds a bit farcical to say at this point, the Montalbano Professor of Leadership Studies at the Sauder School of Business. Professor Birdall became a household name at UBC this year after she penned a controversial blog post that set off a firestorm which eventually ended in the chair of the Board of Governors resigning. She studies issues of gender and diversity in public and private leadership and maintains a lively blog and Twitter presence as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Birdall, you joined UBC fairly recently in 2014 from a previous post with the Rotman School of Management at U of T.
Yes.
Why did you come to UBC after 12 years at U of T?
Well, I had this great opportunity to have outreach funding and sort of a platform for advancing knowledge on gender and diversity and leadership at the Sauter School through the position that they created with John Moltobano, who donated money for the professorship. And so that was attractive to me. I also grew up in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, and my parents still live there, so that was also attractive to return back to my home territory. And the final attraction was the group of faculty that I work with in the organizational behavior unit at the Sauter School. There's lots of research overlap, and I had collaborated with some of them, and it's a good faculty.
So we won't rehash the whole story of the blog post and the subsequent sort of sequence of events, because people are probably familiar with it and they can look it up. But I think we will jump right into that issue nonetheless. One of the most common things I read after your blog post and its follow-up went viral were that since the blog wasn't strictly academic, i.e. it has opinions in it on current events and some speculation, that this wasn't an issue of academic freedom. Can you just dispel that notion once and for all?
Well, it was certainly based on years and years of my own academic research and scholarship. It's very common to take a case study and apply a theoretical lens or analysis that's based on that literature to that case study. So if, for example, I had studied another leadership failure, perhaps I would not have gotten the same reaction as I got when I applied that lens to consider why it was that Arvind Gupta may have unexpectedly resigned from the presidency.
And so you didn't know when you published that it would be touching a nerve.
Well, I'm used to talking about these controversial topics, about discrimination and harassment in the workplace. That's my focus in stereotyping. And I've ventured into this territory many a time. And I guess I was not expecting as strong of a reaction as I got, certainly not with the blog post. I knew I was saying something somewhat controversial about UBC, obviously.
And of all the things that people were saying, it was hardly unusual in that sense either. Lots of people were saying similar things or even much worse on the internet.
Yeah, possibly so. I think that what ended up happening was there just was no information coming out, and my post was one of the first things out there, and it filled a vacuum.
So one of the most interesting parts of the story is, of course, that you're the John Moltobano Professor of Leadership Studies. Do you still talk to John Moltobano and have a sort of cordial or professional relationship with him?
We haven't spoken since our phone call on August 9th. We both would probably refer to it as the Francesca Moltobano Professorship because it was really donated in honor of his mother, who passed away a couple of years ago.
So whatever sort of cordial relationship you had with him before seems to have sort of ended.
Yes, which I find unfortunate. In our August 9th phone conversation, you know, I tried to explain where I was coming from and was hoping that we could, you know, keep that dialogue going, and it didn't continue after that.
In the Smith report, it was very unclear, I guess, what exactly had happened. They presented the conclusion that your academic freedom had been infringed upon, mm-hmm. but they didn't really give any sequence of events of what precipitated that finding. Do you think that there needs to be more details released on that front, or are you comfortable with the agreement that was reached in the terms of reference at the beginning that basically all of that would stay private?
That was all worked out between the UBC administration and the Faculty Association. So those terms of reference weren't something that I really had input into. And they agreed that it would probably be a fuller process and we would have more participation if people's confidentiality was protected in the process.
I guess what I'm getting at is it possible for people to actually learn anything from this if no one knows what they're not supposed to do?
Yeah, I think that is really tricky. I think it's unfortunate that it is so confidential. It'd be nice if perhaps a redacted version with people that we know were involved in the incident and those behaviors and activities could be shared so that we could learn from that.
I think Full disclosure, yeah. Neil has FOI'd it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So if you end up getting that, or perhaps, you know, certain identities are covered up of people who were not named in the allegations, you know, perhaps that would be possible to learn more about who did what and what went wrong specifically.
You have never really received a proper apology from the university. Is that still correct?
Yeah, there really hasn't been a public apology or acknowledgement.
And that's echoed in what we heard with the students we had on the show last week, Caitlin Cunningham and Caitlin Russell, who said Martha apologized to the media, but they certainly didn't feel like the apology was actually to them.
Yeah, or necessarily sincere. I think the university itself seems to, at the moment at least, among the leadership, have a real culture of not really owning up to mistakes. Every institution makes mistakes, but when they fail to admit those mistakes is when they start to lose credibility.
I was wondering, are there conditions under which it would be possible for the donor of a chair to talk to the person who occupies that chair and it be, like, okay from all sides?
I think there would be ways that that could be managed. I think the condition that Montalbano was in when he called me was not conducive to an open-minded discussion or learning experience. It would have been nice if the leadership at Sauter had, at that point, knowing that he was going to call me, intervened. That's where the leadership as umbrella comes in. You know, you protect the people below. You don't direct people down to those below you as a leader to go after them.
So one of the things that you have recently been elected to is the Presidential Search Committee. I think we were wondering how your research tends to inform how you approach being a member of this committee.
You know, I research group decision making and I research leadership. So both of those things really come into being on, I guess, any committee, especially one that is designed to select a leader. One of the things that I'll be doing is really pushing for process and transparency as much as possible, and also for faculty input. So I'm really hoping, as the faculty representative, to get faculty to have an opportunity to meet with the finalists, at least a panel perhaps of faculty, of representative faculty from across the university.
Another interesting aspect I find about this is that your dad, Robert Birdall, is a former university president himself, having served at the University of Texas, UC Berkeley, and the University of Oregon. Is this something you chatted to him about, you know, for example, on the phone or around the dinner table?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some differences between the American and the Canadian systems, which I'm learning about. One of the things that we were given as search committee members was Ross Paul's book on leadership in crisis, which goes through, you know, some of the distinctions between the landscape in Canada for higher education and the U.S. And I've been also reading up some other books, William Bowen and Eugene Tobin's book on the role of faculty governance in universities and how that's evolved over time. So I'm trying to learn as much as I can. Obviously, my conversations with my dad throughout my life have been really informative and great, and it's been nice to have that perspective over the years on the university, both, you know, as my faculty experience, but also having his very broad range of experience.
So it's more of just an internalized thing at this point, that you've seen that perspective for many, many years, and just sort of know it anyways.
It's internalized, but as I've been going through, you know, my experience here and also now as a search committee member on the Presidential Search Committee, I've been asking him much more pointed questions and sort of drilling him, calling him up at night and saying, hey, what about this? And what's the history of that? And so I've been a more active student, I guess.
I wanted to ask you maybe more sort of to your research interests. So you study gender and ethnic diversity in leadership in the corporate world, as well as in the public sector. I was having dinner with my dad, and he's also an academic, and I was sort of chatting with him about the Gupta resignation and your comments on it. And his immediate reaction was, oh, that those old boys club locker room mentalities might still regrettably sort of exist in the private sector, but not in academia. It's impossible. And I was wondering, like, are academics naive about the supposedly, like, enlightened or progressive work environment?
Well, I think it really varies from department to department and university to university, just like it does from company to company. But the statistics definitely reveal that there's something going on, because we have very little diversity at the top of universities still, and this one in particular. So there must be something working against women and minorities if they're not represented proportionally in leadership positions or in full professorship positions. A lot of it's unintentional. It's not necessarily this old boy, ha ha ha, let's leave other people out dynamic. And a lot of research has revealed just how implicit and kind of accidental a lot of this bias is.
Is there something that universities especially need to pay attention to improve those dynamics as compared to the private sector?
I think that, you know, the tenure clock, a lot of the way in which the career has been designed has been around sort of men's schedules and family arrangements that are more traditional. And so there's been some adjustments made to that. Mentoring relationships, co-authorships, those kinds of things all come into play. You know, there's been a lot of interesting analysis of letters of recommendation for male and female applicants for faculty positions that reveal that, you know, men are mentioned as being, you know, brilliant, or their talent is really emphasized, whereas women's personalities are more scrutinized in those letters. So there's all these ways in which our implicit biases creep in. It's not just men doing the bias, it's also women.
And one of your recent blog posts was about 10 principles for a well-run, well-governed university. Mm-hmm. Is university governance going to be a new particular niche of research interest for you?
It might be. I mean, I am now starting to read up on this and learn a lot about university governance and its history. It is an organization, and it's a pretty fundamental and important organization with great influence on our culture, our society, and the next generation. So I might do some more directed research at universities. The blog post on the 10 principles, I mean, it did stem out of the resignation of Gupta. And as I started thinking more about the nature of the problem of what happened to me, what happened to Gupta, I started trying to have conversations with people about, okay, well, what are those principles? What lines do you not cross? What are the roles of these different entities at the university? And one of the things that really struck me, too, is that when we say the university, at least at UBC, we're talking about the board. The university really is the students and the faculty. So I think another thing that we need to do is work with our language a bit to represent what is the university. When I wrote my blog post and I talked about university leadership, I wasn't thinking of the Board of Governors, because to me, the university leadership is the academic leadership of university.
Yeah, that was a frequently misunderstood point in analyzing that.
Yeah.
That it was about the deans, not about the board.
Yeah, the deans and on down.
Yeah, and I noticed in those 10 principles that you really emphasize the core role that faculty has in the governance, or should have in governance at every level.
Well, it's tricky because the faculty is a very broad group at the university, and sometimes, you know, it's hard to organize the faculty. Sometimes the power that they exercise is more of a veto power. So they're not necessarily driving a vision, but they're vetoing a vision. So I can see why administrators might grow a little bit frustrated at times.
Now that we're a couple months on from the very whirlwind fall that you had, do you have any reflections on key takeaways from your end about what you learned and maybe what UBC could learn?
One of the good things that I've learned is people across campus have reached out to me, and it might normally take 10 or 20 years to figure out who in all the different departments on campus share your values and principles and care about what you care about. So I've learned that really quickly, which is nice. I also think that what I did, I mean, some people call it heroic. I think it was just what I had to do. I realized it was, the cards were already fixed. When you know that there is a group of people within an organization that's very powerful that has it out for you, then the death is going to be public or it's going to be private. And it's better to have a public death so that it at least means something. I'm not saying I'm dead, but it becomes a public fight. It's so important for everyone to speak out, just like with the sexual assault victims, so that they get out into the public discourse and so that we can do something about them. Legalese and administrative processes tends to sweep things under the rug. And one of the ways that the students really struck me in their CBC interview was that they started to feel managed after 6 or 7 months. They realized that they're going to all these meetings and all these taxing conversations, and that they were starting to just sort of feel manipulated and managed, like nothing was being done. I think we got about as much done as we could with a more public struggle than we could have if we had sort of done a behind-the-scenes type of approach. But I think it's been painful for everybody involved.
And you need that at some point. The board actually is also trying to be a lot more transparent at their last meeting. Mm-hmm. And I really just don't think that could have happened if Montalbano had stayed on his chair.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. We've been talking to Jennifer Birdall from the Sauter School of Business. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM and podcasted at ubcinsiders.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders, check out the blog ubcinsiders.ca, and email us. We're both easy to find on Google. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Mayan. Next week, we'll be talking about the Canadian International Resources and Development Institute, a.k.a. CIRDI, a think tank housed at UBC that deals with the politics of resource extraction. Bjorn Stein is a student concerned with CIRDI's activities, both at home and in developing countries, while Cassie Doyle is CIRDI's recently hired CEO. We'll be hearing from both of them.
Can't wait. Insiders out.